and secret technique, and as he marveled, it suddenly struck him that here was the principle of the two swords. The chain was a single length. The ball functioned as the right sword, the sickle as the left. "Of course," he cried triumphantly. "That's it! That's the Yaegaki style!" Now confident of victory, he leapt back, putting 5 feet between the two of them. He transferred his sword to his right hand and hurled it straight as an arrow. Baikan twisted his body and the sword glanced off, burying itself in the root of a nearby tree. But as he twisted, the chain wrapped itself around his torso. Before he could even cry out, Musashi slammed his full weight into him. Baikan got his hand as far as the hilt of his sword, but Musashi broke his hold with a sharp chop to the wrist. In a continuation of the same motion, he drew the weapon and split Baikan open, like lightning splitting a tree. As he pulled the blade down, he twisted ever so slightly. "What a pity," thought Musashi. As the story was later told, he even uttered a sigh of compassion as the originator of the Yaegaki style breathed his last.
"The Karatake slice!" exclaimed an admiring voice. "Straight down the trunk! No different from splitting bamboo! It's the first time I've ever seen it!"
Musashi turned and said,
"Why, if it isn't Gonnosuke from Kiso, what are you doing here? It's been a long time, hasn't it? The god of Mitsumine must have arranged it, perhaps with the aid of my mother, who taught me so much before she died."
They fell to chatting, but Musashi suddenly stopped and cried, "Iori!"
"He's all right. I rescued him from that pig of a priest and had him climb a tree."
Iori, watching them from a high branch, started to speak, but instead shaded his eyes and looked toward a small flat area beyond the edge of the forest. Kuro, tied to a tree, had caught Oko's kimono sleeve with his teeth. She yanked desperately at the sleeve. In a trice, it tore off, and she ran away. The lone survivor, the other priest, was hobbling along, leaning heavily on his lance, blood flowing from a head wound. The dog, perhaps crazed by the smell of blood, started making a terrible racket. The noise echoed and re-echoed for a time, but then the rope gave way, and the dog went after Oko. When he reached him, the priest lifted his lance and aimed for the dog's head. Wounded in the neck, the beast ran into the woods.
"That woman's getting away!" cried Iori.
"Never mind, you can come down now.
There's an injured priest over there. Shouldn't you catch him?"
"Forget it. He doesn't matter anymore."
"The woman's probably the one from the Oinu tea house," said Gonnosuke.
He explained his presence, the heaven-sent coincidence that had enabled him to come to Musashi's assistance. Deeply grateful, Musashi said,
"You killed the man who fired the gun?"
"No,"
Gonnosuke smiled.
"Not me, my staff. I knew ordinarily you could take care of men like that. But if they were going to use a gun, I decided I'd better do something. So I came here ahead of them and slipped up behind the man while it was still dark."
They checked the corpses. 7 had been killed with the staff, only 5 with the sword. Musashi said,
"I haven't done anything except defend myself, but this area belongs to the shrine. I feel I should explain things to the government official in charge. Then he can ask his questions and get the incident cleared up."
On their way down the mountain, they ran into a contingent of armed officials at the bridge at Kosaruzawa. Musashi told his story. The captain in charge listened, seemingly puzzled, but nevertheless ordered Musashi tied up. Shocked, Musashi wanted to know why, since he was on his way to report to them in the first place.
"Get moving!" ordered the captain.
Angry as Musashi was about being treated as an ordinary criminal, there was still another surprise coming. There were more officials farther down the mountain. By the time they arrived in the town, his guard numbered no fewer than 100. Brother Disciples.
"Come now, no more tears!"
Gonosuke hugged Iori to his chest.
You're a man, aren't you?
It's because I'm a man that I'm crying. He lifted his head, opened his mouth wide, and bawled at the sky.
They didn't arrest Musashi. He gave himself up.
Gonosuke's mild words masked his own deep concern.
Come on, let's go now.
No, not until they bring him back.
They'll let him go soon. They'll have to. Do you want me to leave you here by yourself?
Gonosuke walked a few paces away. Iori didn't move. Just then, Baiken's dog came charging out of the woods, his muzzle a dull, bloody red.
Help!
Screamed Iori, running to Gonosuke's side.
You're worn out, aren't you? Look, would you like me to carry you piggyback?
Iori, pleased, mumbled his thanks, climbed on the proffered back, and wrapped his arms around the broad shoulders. With the festival over the night before, the visitors had departed. A gentle breeze wafted bits of bamboo wrapping and scraps of paper along the deserted streets. Passing the Oinu tea house, Gonosuke glanced inside, intending to go by unnoticed. But Iori piped out,
"There's the woman who ran away!
I imagine that's where she'd be." He stopped and wondered aloud, "If the officials dragged in Musashi, why didn't they arrest her too?" When Oko saw Gonosuke, her eyes blazed with anger. Seeing she seemed to be hurriedly gathering her belongings together, Gonosuke laughed.
"Going on a trip?"
he asked.
"None of your business. Don't think I don't know you, you meddling scoundrel. You killed my husband."
"You brought it on yourselves."
"I'll get even one of these days."
"She-demon!"
Iori shouted over Gonosuke's head. Retreating into the back room, Oko laughed scornfully.
"You're fine ones to be saying bad things about me when you're the thieves who broke into the treasure house."
"What's this?" Gonosuke let Iori slide to the ground and went into the tea house.
"Who are you calling thieves?"
"You can't fool me. Say that again, and thieves."
As Gonosuke grabbed her arm, she turned and stabbed at him with a dagger. Not bothering with his staff, he wrested the dagger from her hand and sent her sprawling through the front door. Oko jumped up and screamed,
"Help! Thieves! I'm being attacked!"
Gonosuke took aim and hurled the dagger. It entered her back and the point came out in front. Oko pitched forward onto her face. From nowhere, Kuro bounded forth and was at the body, first slurping blood hungrily, then lifting his head to howl at the sky.
"Look at those eyes!" exclaimed Iori in horror.
Oko's cry of thieves had caught the ears of the excited villagers. Sometime before dawn, someone had broken into the temple treasure house. It was clearly the work of outsiders, for the religious treasures, old swords, mirrors, and the like, had been left untouched, but a fortune in gold dust, bullion, and cash, accumulated over a period of many years, was missing. The news had leaked out slowly and was still unconfirmed. The effect of Oko's scream, the most tangible proof so far, was electric.
"There they are! Inside the Oinu!"
The cries attracted a still larger mob armed with bamboo spears, boar guns, sticks, and rocks. In no time, it seemed that the whole village was surrounding the tea house, thirsty for blood. Gonosuke and Iori ducked out the back and for the next several hours were driven from hiding place to hiding place. But now they had an explanation. Musashi had been arrested not for the crime he was about to confess, but as a thief. It was not until they reached Shomaru Pass that they shook off the last of the search parties.
"You can see Musashi no plane from here," said Iori. "I wonder if my teacher's all right."
I imagine he's in prison by now and being questioned."
"Isn't there any way to save him?"
"There must be."
"Please do something. Please."
"You don't have to beg. He's like a teacher to me, too. But, Iori, there's not much you can do here. Can you make it back home by yourself?"
"I suppose so. If I have to."
"Good.
What about you?
I'm going back to Chichibu. If they refuse to release Musashi, I'll get him out some way, even if I have to tear the prison down.
For emphasis, he thumped the ground once with his staff. Iori, who had seen the power of this weapon, quickly nodded his agreement.
That's a boy. You go back and watch over things until I bring Musashi home safe and sound.
Placing his staff under his arm, he turned back toward Chichibu. Iori didn't feel lonely or afraid, nor did he worry about getting lost. But he was dreadfully sleepy, and as he walked along under the warm sun, he could hardly keep his eyes open. At Sakamoto, he saw a stone Buddha by the wayside and lay down in its shadow. The evening light was fading when he awoke and heard soft voices on the other side of the statue. Feeling rather guilty about eavesdropping, he pretended he was still asleep. There were two of them, one sitting on a tree stump, the other on a rock. Tied to a tree a little distance away were two horses with lacquered boxes suspended from both sides of their saddles. A wooden tag attached to one of the boxes said, "From Shimotsuke Province. For use in the construction of the West Encirclement. Lacquerware supplier to the Shogun." To Iori, who now peeked around the statue, they did not look like the normal run of well-fed castle officials. Their eyes were too sharp, their bodies too muscular. The older one was a vigorous-looking man of more than 50. The last rays of the sun reflected strongly from his bonnet-like hat, which came down over both ears and projected out in front, concealing his features. His companion was a slender, wiry youth wearing a forelock that suited his boyish face. His head was covered with a suo-dyed hand towel tied beneath his chin.
"How about the lacquerware boxes?" the younger one asked. "That was pretty good, wasn't it?" "Yes, that was clever, making people think we're connected with the work going on at the castle. I wouldn't have thought of that myself."
"I'll have to teach you these things little by little."
"Careful now. Don't start making fun of your elders. But who knows, maybe in 4 or 5 years, old Daizo will be taking orders from you."
"Well, young people do grow up. Old people just get older, no matter how hard they work at staying young."
"Do you think that's what I'm doing?"
"It's obvious, isn't it? You're always thinking of your age, and that's what makes you so devoted to seeing your mission accomplished."
"You know me pretty well, I guess."
"Shouldn't we be going?"
"Yes, night's catching up with us."
"I don't like the idea of being caught up with."
"Ha ha! If you scare easily, you can't have much confidence in what you're doing."
"I haven't been at this business very long. Even the sound of the wind makes me nervous sometimes."
"That's because you still think of yourself as an ordinary thief. If you keep in mind that you're doing it for the good of the country, you'll be all right."
"You always say that. I believe you, but something keeps telling me I'm not doing the right thing."
"You have to have the courage of your convictions."
But the admonition sounded slightly unconvincing, as though Daizo was reassuring himself. The youth jumped lightly into the saddle and rode on ahead.
"Keep your eye on me,"
he called back over his shoulder.
"If I see anything, I'll signal."
The road made a long descent to the south. Iori watched from behind the stone Buddha for a minute, then decided to follow them. Somehow the idea had formed in his mind that these were the treasure house thieves. Once or twice they looked back cautiously. Apparently finding nothing to warrant alarm, they seemed to forget about him after a time. Before long, the evening glow was gone, and it was too dark to see more than a few yards ahead. The two riders were almost at the edge of Musashino Plain when the youth pointed and said,
"There, chief! You can see the lights of Ogimachiya."
The road was flattening out. A short distance ahead, the Iruma River, twisting like a discarded obi, shone silvery in the moonlight. Iori was now being careful to remain inconspicuous. His idea that these men were the thieves had become a conviction, and he knew all about bandits from his days in Hotengahara. Bandits were vicious men who would commit mayhem over a single egg or a handful of red beans. Unprovoked murder was nothing to them. By and by, they entered the town of Ogimachiya. Daizo lifted his arm and said,
"Jota, we'll stop here and have a bite to eat. The horses have to be fed, and I'd like a smoke."
They tied the horses in front of a dimly lit shop and went inside. Jota stationed himself by the door, keeping his eyes on the boxes the whole time he was eating. When he was finished, he went out and fed the horses. Iori went into a food shop across the street, and when the two men rode off, he grabbed the last handful of his rice and ate it as he walked. They rode side by side now. The road was dark but level.
"Jota, did you send a courier to Kiso?"
"Yes, I took care of that."
"What time did you tell them?"
"Midnight. We should be there on schedule." In the still night, Iori caught enough of their conversation to know that Daizo called his companion by a boy's name, while Jota addressed the older man as chief. This might mean nothing more than that he was the head of a gang, but somehow Iori got the impression they were father and son. This made them not mere bandits, but hereditary bandits, very dangerous men he would never be able to capture by himself. But if he could stick with them long enough, he could report their whereabouts to the officials. The town of Kawagoe was fast asleep, as soundless as a swamp in the dead of night. Having passed rows of darkened houses, the two riders turned off the highway and began climbing a hill. A stone marker at the bottom said, "Forest of the Head-Burying Mound, above." Climbing up through the bushes alongside the path, Iori reached the top first. There was a lone pine tree of great size, to which a horse was tied. Squatting at the base were three men dressed like ronin, arms folded on their knees, looking expectantly toward the path. Iori had hardly ensconced himself in a hiding place before one of the men stood up and said,
"It's Daizo, all right."
All three ran forward and exchanged jovial salutations. Daizo and his confederates had not met for nearly 4 years. Before long, they got down to work. Under Daizo's direction, they rolled a huge stone aside and began digging. Dirt was piled to one side, a great store of gold and silver to the other. Jota unloaded the boxes from the horses and dumped out their contents, which, as Iori had suspected, consisted of the missing treasure from Mitsumine Shrine. Added to the previous cash, the total booty must have had a value of many tens of thousands of ryo. The precious metals were poured into plain straw sacks and loaded on three horses. The empty lacquered boxes, along with other objects that had served their purpose, were dumped into the hole. After the ground had been smoothed over, the stone was restored to its original position.
"That should do it," said Daizo. "Time for a smoke."
He sat down by the pine tree and took out his pipe. The others brushed off their clothes and joined him. During the 4 years of his so-called pilgrimage, Daizo had covered the Kanto plain very thoroughly. There were few temples or shrines without a plaque attesting to his generosity, the extent of which was no secret. Strangely, though, no one had thought to ask how he had come by all this money. Daizo, Jotaro, and the three men from Kiso sat in a circle for about an hour, discussing future plans. That it was now risky for Daizo to return to Edo was not in doubt, but one of them had to go. There was gold in the storehouse at Shibaura to be recovered, and documents to be burned, and something had to be done about Akemi. Just before sunup, Daizo and the three men began the journey down the Koshu High Road to Kiso. Jotaro on foot set off in the opposite direction. The stars Iori was gazing at offered no answer to his question, who to follow? Under the transparently blue autumn sky, the strong rays of the afternoon sun seemed to sink right into Jotaro's skin. His head filled with thoughts of his role in the coming age, he was strolling across the Musashino Plain as though he owned it. Casting a somewhat apprehensive glance behind him, he thought, he's still there. Thinking the boy might want to talk to him, he'd already stopped a couple of times, but the boy had made no attempt to catch up with him. Deciding to find out what was going on, Jotaro chose a clump of eulalia and hid in it. When Iori reached the stretch of road where he'd last seen Jotaro, he began looking around worriedly. Abruptly, Jotaro stood up and called out, "You there, runt!" Iori gasped but recovered quickly. Knowing he couldn't get away, he walked on past and asked nonchalantly, "What do you want? You've been following me, haven't you?" "Uh-uh." Iori shook his head innocently. "I'm on my way to Juniso Nakano." "You're lying! You were following me!" "I don't know what you're talking about." Iori started to break and run, but Jotaro caught him by the back of his kimono. "Out with it!"
"But I don't know anything."
"Liar," said Jotaro, tightening his grip. "Somebody sent you after me. You're a spy."
"And you? You're a lousy thief."
"What?" Jotaro shouted, his face almost touching Iori's. Iori bent nearly to the ground, broke loose, and took off. Jotaro hesitated a minute, then set off after him. Off to one side, Iori could see thatched roofs scattering about like wasp nests. He ran through a field of reddish autumn grass, kicking apart several dusty molehills.
"Help! Help! Thief!" cried Iori.
The small village he was entering was inhabited by families charged with fighting fires on the plain. Iori could hear a blacksmith's hammer and anvil. People came running out of dark stables and houses where persimmons had been hung to dry. Waving his arms, Iori panted,
"The man with the bandana! Chasing me! He's a thief! Capture him! Please! Oh! Here he comes!"
The villagers stared in bewilderment, some looking fearfully at the two youths, but to Iori's dismay, they made no move to capture Jotaro.
"He's a thief! He stole from the temple!"
He stopped halfway through the village, conscious that the only thing disturbing the peaceful atmosphere was his own shouting. Then he took to his heels again and found a place to hide and catch his breath. Jotaro cautiously slowed down to a dignified walk. The villagers watched in silence. He certainly didn't look like either a robber or a ronin up to no good. In fact, he seemed like a clean-cut youth, incapable of committing any kind of crime. Disgusted that the villagers, grown-ups, wouldn't stand up to a thief, Iori made up his mind to hurry back to Nakano, where he could at least present his case to people he knew. He left the road and struck out across the plain. When he could see the cryptomeria grove behind the house, there was only a mile to go. Filled with relief, he changed his pace from a trot to a full run. Suddenly, he saw that his way was blocked by a man with both arms outstretched. He didn't have time to figure out how Jotaro had got ahead of him, but he was on home ground now. He jumped back and drew his sword.
"You bastard!"
he screamed. Jotaro rushed forward empty-handed and caught Iori's collar, but the boy pulled free and jumped 10 feet to the side.
"Son of a bitch!"
muttered Jotaro, feeling warm blood running down his right arm from a 2-inch cut. Iori took a stance and fixed his mind on the lesson Musashi had drummed into him. Eyes, eyes, eyes. His strength concentrated in his bright pupils, his whole being seemed to be channeled into a pair of fiery eyes. Outstared, Jotaro whipped out his own sword.
"I'll have to kill you,"
he snarled. Iori, taking fresh courage from the strike he had scored, charged, his attack the one he always employed against Musashi. Jotaro was having second thoughts. He hadn't believed Iori could use a sword, Now he put his full strength into the fight. For the sake of his comrades, he had to get this meddling child out of the way. Seemingly ignoring Iori's attack, he pressed forward and swung viciously, but unsuccessfully. After two or three parries, Iori turned around, ran, stopped, and charged again. When Jotaro countered, he retreated again, encouraged to see that his strategy was working. He was drawing the opponent into his own territory. Pausing to catch his breath, Jotaro looked around the dark grove and shouted, "Where are you, you stupid little bastard?" The answer was a shower of bark and leaves. Jotaro raised his head and shouted, "I see you!" Though all he could actually see through the foliage was a couple of stars. Jotaro started climbing toward the rustling sound Iori made as he moved out on a limb. From there, unfortunately, there was nowhere to go. "I've got you now. Unless you can grow wings, you'd better give up. Otherwise, you're dead." Iori moved silently back to the fork of two limbs. Jotaro climbed slowly and carefully. When Jotaro reached out to grab him, Iori again moved out on one of the limbs. With a grunt, Jotaro caught hold of a branch with both hands and started to pull himself up, giving Iori the chance he'd been waiting for. With a resounding whack, his sword connected with the branch Jotaro was on. It broke, and Jotaro plummeted to the ground.
"How do you like that, thief?" gloated Iori.
His fall broken by lower branches, Jotaro wasn't seriously injured, except for his pride. He cursed and started back up the tree, this time with the speed of a leopard. When he was under Iori's feet again, Iori slashed back and forth with his sword to keep him from getting any nearer. While they were locked in stalemate, the plaintive tones of a shakuhachi came to their ears. For a moment, they both stopped and listened. Then Jotaro decided to try reasoning with his adversary. "All right," he said. "You put up a better fight than I expected. I admire you for that. If you'll tell me who asked you to follow me, I'll let you go."
"Admit you're licked."
"Are you crazy?"
"I may not be very big, but I'm Misawa Iori, the only disciple of Miyamoto Musashi. Begging mercy would be an insult to my master's reputation. Give up."
"What?" said Jotaro incredulously.
Say that once more."
His voice was shrill and unsteady.
"Listen carefully," Iori said proudly. "I am Misawa Iori, the only pupil of Miyamoto Musashi. Does that surprise you?"
Jotaro was ready to admit defeat. With a mixture of doubt and curiosity, he asked, "How is my teacher? Is he well? Where is he?" Astonished, but keeping a safe distance from Jotaro, who was moving closer, Iori said,
"Ha! Sensei would never have a thief for a disciple."
"Don't call me that.
Didn't Musashi ever mention Jotaro?"
"Jotaro?
If you're really Musashi's pupil, you must have heard him mention my name sometime or other. I was about your age then."
"That's a lie."
"No, it isn't. It's the truth."
Overcome with nostalgia, Jotaro reached out to Iori and tried to explain that they should be friends because they were disciples of the same teacher. Still wary, Iori took a swipe at his ribs. Squeezed precariously between two limbs, Jotaro barely succeeded in clasping his hand around Iori's wrist. For some reason, Iori let go of the branch he was holding onto. When they fell together, one landing on top of the other, both knocked senseless. The light in Musashi's new house was visible from all directions, since, though the roof was in place, the walls hadn't been built yet. Takuan, arriving the day before for an after-the-storm call, had decided to wait for Musashi's return. Today, just after nightfall, his enjoyment of his solitary surroundings had been interrupted by a mendicant priest asking for hot water to go with his supper. After his meager meal of rice balls, the aged priest had taken it upon himself to play his shakuhachi for Takuan, fingering his instrument in a halting, amateurish fashion. Yet as Takuan listened, the music struck him as having genuine feeling, albeit of the artless sort, often expressed in poems by non-poets. He thought, too, that he could recognize the emotion the player was attempting to wring from his instrument. It was remorse, from the first off-key note to the last, a wailing cry of repentance. It seemed to be the story of the man's life, but then, Takuan reflected, that couldn't have been too different from his own. Whether people were great or not, there was not much variety in their inner life experience. Any difference lay merely in how they dealt with common human weaknesses. To Takuan, both he and the other man were basically a bundle of illusions wrapped in human skin.
"I do believe I've seen you before somewhere," Takuan murmured thoughtfully.
The priest blinked his almost sightless eyes and said,
"Now that you mention it, I thought I recognized your voice. Aren't you Takuan Soho from Tajima?"
Takuan's memory cleared. Moving the lamp closer to the man's face, he said,
"You're Aoki Tanzaemon, aren't you?"
"Then you are, Takuan. Oh, I wish I could crawl into a hole and hide this miserable flesh of mine."
"How strange we should meet in a place like this. It's been nearly 10 years since that time at the Shippoji, hasn't it?"
"Thinking of those days gives me a chill."
Then he said stiffly,
"Now that I'm reduced to wandering about in darkness, this wretched sack of bones is sustained only by thoughts of my son."
"Do you have a son?"
"I've been told he's with that man who has tied up in the old cryptomeria tree. Takezo, was it? I hear he's called Miyamoto Musashi now. The two of them are said to have come east."
"You mean your son is Musashi's disciple?"
"That's what they say." I was so ashamed. I couldn't face Musashi, so I resolved to put the boy out of my mind. But now he's 17 this year. If only I could have one look at him and see what kind of man he's grown up to be, I'd be ready and willing to die."
"So Jotaro's your son. I didn't know that," said Takua.
Tanzaemon nodded. There was no hint in his shriveled form of the proud captain filled with lust for Otsu. Takuan gazed at him with pity, pained to see Tanzaemon so tormented by guilt. Seeing that despite his priestly garb he lacked even the comfort of religious faith, Takuan decided the first thing he should do was bring him face to face with the Buddha Amida, whose infinite mercy saves even those guilty of the 10 evils and the 5 deadly sins. There would be time enough after he'd recovered from his despair to look for Jotaro. Takuan gave him the name of a Zen temple in Edo.
"If you tell them I sent you, they'll let you stay as long as you wish. As soon as I have time, I'll come and we'll have a long talk. I have an idea where your son might be. I'll do everything I can to make sure you see him in the not-too-distant future. In the meantime, give up brooding. Even after a man's 50 or 60, he can still know happiness, even do useful work. You may live for many more years. Talk it over with the priests when you get to the temple."
Takuan shooed Tanzaemon out the door, unceremoniously and without showing any sympathy, but Tanzaemon seemed to appreciate the unsentimental attitude. After numerous bows of gratitude, he picked up his reed hat and shakuhachi and left. For fear of slipping, Tanzaemon chose to go through the woods, where the path sloped more gently. Presently, his cane struck an obstacle. Feeling around with his hands, he was surprised to find 2 bodies lying motionless on the damp ground. He hurried back to the cabin.
"Takuan, can you help me? I came across 2 unconscious boys in the woods."
Takuan roused himself and came outside. Tanzaemon continued,
I don't have any medicine with me, and I can't see well enough to get water for them.
Takuan slipped on his sandals and shouted toward the bottom of the hill. His voice carried easily. A farmer answered, asking him what he wanted. Takuan told him to bring a torch, some men, and some water. While he waited, he suggested to Tanzaimon that the road was the better way to go, described it in detail, and sent him on his way. Halfway down the hill, Tanzaimon passed the men coming up. When Takuan arrived with the farmers, Jotaro had come too and was sitting underneath the tree, looking dazed. One hand resting on Iori's arm, he was debating whether to revive him and find out what he wanted to know or to get away from there. He reacted to the torch like a nocturnal animal, tensing his muscles, ready to run.
"What's going on here?" asked Takuan.
As he looked more closely, inquisitive interest turned to surprise, a surprise matched by Jotaro's. The young man was much taller than the boy Takuan had known, and his face had changed quite a bit.
"You're Jotaro, aren't you?"
The youth placed both hands on the ground and bowed. "Yes, I am," he replied haltingly, almost fearfully. He'd recognize Takuan instantly.
"Well, I must say, you've grown up to be a fine young man."
Turning his attention to Iori, he put his arm around him and ascertained that he was still alive. Iori revived, and after looking around curiously for a few seconds, burst into tears.
"What's the matter?" Takuan asked soothingly. "Are you hurt?"
Iori shook his head and blubbered.
"I'm not hurt, but they took my teacher away. He's in the prison in Chichibu."
With Iori bawling the way he was, Takuan had trouble understanding him, but soon the basic facts of the story became clear. Takuan, realizing the seriousness of the situation, was nearly as grieved as Iori. Jotaro, too, was deeply agitated. In a shaky voice, he said abruptly,
"Takuan, I have something to tell you. Could we go somewhere where we can talk?"
"He's one of the thieves," said Iori. "You can't trust him. Anything he says will be a lie."
He pointed accusingly at Jotaro, and they glared at each other.
"Shut up, both of you. Let me decide who's right and who's wrong."
Takuan led them back to the house and ordered them to build a fire outside. Seating himself by the fire, Takuan commanded them to do likewise. Iori hesitated, his expression saying very plainly he had no intention of being friendly with a thief. But seeing Takuan and Jotaro talking amiably over old times, he felt a pang of jealousy and grudgingly took a seat near them. Jotaro lowered his voice and, like a woman confessing her sins before the Buddha, became very earnest.
"For 4 years now, I've been receiving training from a man named Daizo. He comes from Narai in Kiso. I've learned about his aspirations and what he wants to do for the world. I'd be willing to die for him, if necessary. And that's why I've tried to help him with his work. Well, it does hurt to be called a thief. But I'm still Musashi's disciple. Even though I'm separated from him, I've never been apart from him in spirit, not even for a day."
He hurried on, not waiting to be asked questions.
"Daizo and I have sworn by the gods of heaven and earth not to tell anyone what our aim in life is. I can't even tell you. Still, I can't stand by when Musashi's been thrown in prison. I'll go to Chichibu tomorrow and confess."
Takuan said,
"Then it was you and Daizo who robbed the treasure house?"
"Yes,"
Jotaro replied without the slightest sign of contrition.
"So you are a thief," said Takuan.
Jotaro lowered his head to avoid Takuan's eyes.
"No, no," he murmured lamely. "We're not just common burglars."
"I was not aware that thieves came in different varieties."
"Well, what I'm trying to say is, we don't do these things for our own gain. We do them for the people. It's a matter of moving public property for the good of the public."
"I don't understand reasoning like that. Are you telling me your robberies are righteous crimes? Are you saying you're like the bandit heroes in Chinese novels? If so, it's a poor imitation.
I can't answer that without revealing my secret agreement with Daizo.
Ha ha! You aren't going to let yourself be taken in, are you?
I don't care what you say. I'll confess only to save Musashi. I hope you'll put in a good word for me with him later.
I wouldn't be able to think of a good word to put in. Musashi's innocent. Whether you confess or not, he'll be freed eventually. It seems to me it's far more important for you to take yourself to the Buddha. Use me as an intermediary and confess everything to him.
Buddha?
That's what I said. To hear you tell it, you're doing something grand for the sake of other people. In fact, you're putting yourself before others. Has it not occurred to you that you leave quite a number of people unhappy?
One can't consider himself when one is working on behalf of society.
Stupid fool!
He struck Jotaro soundly on the cheek with his fist.
One's self is the basis of everything. Every action is a manifestation of the self. A person who doesn't know himself can do nothing for others.
What I meant, I wasn't acting to satisfy my own desires.
Shut up! Don't you see you're barely grown? There's nothing more frightening than a half-baked do-gooder who knows nothing of the world but takes it upon himself to tell the world what's good for it. You needn't say any more about what you and Daizo are doing. I have a very good idea already. What are you crying about? Blow your nose!
Ordered to bed, Jotaro lay down obediently, but couldn't get to sleep for thinking of Musashi. He clasped his hands together over his chest and silently begged forgiveness. Tears dribbled into his ears. He turned on his side and began thinking about Otsu. His cheek hurt. Otsu's tears would hurt worse. Still, revealing his secret promise to Daizo was inconceivable, even if Takuan tried to get it out of him in the morning, as he was sure to do. He got up without making a sound, went outside and looked up at the stars. He would have to hurry. The night was nearly gone.
Stop!
The voice froze Jotaro where he was. Behind him, Takuan was a huge shadow. The priest came to his side and put his arm around him.
Are you determined to go and confess?
Jotaro nodded.
That's not very intelligent, said Takuan sympathetically. You'll die a dog's death. You seem to think that if you give yourself up, Musashi will be set free, but it isn't that simple. The officials will keep Musashi in prison until you tell them everything you've been refusing to tell me. And you'll be tortured until you talk, whether it takes a year, 2 years, or more.
Jotaro hung his head.
Is that what you want? To die a dog's death? But you have no choice now. Either you confess everything under torture, or you tell me everything. As a disciple of the Buddha, I'll not sit in judgment. I'll relay it to Amida.
Jotaro said nothing.
There is one other way. By the sheerest chance, I happened to meet your father last night. He now wears the robes of a mendicant priest. Of course, I never dreamed you were here too. I sent him to a temple in Edo. If you've made up your mind to die, it'll be good for you to see him first. And when you see him, you can ask him if I'm not right. Jotaro, there are three paths open to you. You must decide for yourself which one to follow.
He turned away and started back into the house. Jotaro realized that the shakuhachi he had heard the night before must have belonged to his father. Without being told, he could imagine how his father must look and feel as he wandered around from place to place.
Takua, wait! I'll talk. I'll tell everything to the Buddha, including my promise to Daizo.
He caught hold of the priest's sleeve, and the two went into the grove. Jotaro confessed in a long monologue, omitting nothing. Takua neither moved a muscle nor spoke.
"That's all," said Jotaro.
"Everything?"
"Every single thing."
"Good."
Takuan remained silent for fully an hour. Dawn came. Crows began cawing. Dew glistened everywhere. Takuan sat on the root of a cryptomeria. Jotaro leaned against another tree, head bowed, waiting for the tongue-lashing he knew was coming. When Takuan finally spoke, he appeared to have no more doubts.
"I must say, you got mixed up with quite a crowd. Heaven help them. They don't understand which way the world is turning. It's a good thing you told me before matters got worse."
Reaching into his kimono, he produced, surprisingly enough, 2 gold coins and handed them to Jotaro.
"You'd better get away as fast as you can. The slightest delay may bring disaster not only to you, but to your father and your teacher. Get as far away as possible, but don't go near the Koshu High Road or the Nakasendo. By noon today, they'll be carrying out a rigid check on all travelers."
"What'll happen to Sensei? I can't go away and leave him where he is."
"Leave that to me. After a year or two, when things have quieted down, you can go to see him and make your apologies. Then I'll put in a good word for you."
"Goodbye."
"Just a minute."
"Yes?"
"Go to Edo first. In Azabu, there's a Zen temple called Shōjuang. Your father should be there by now. Take this seal I received from the Daitokuji. They'll know it's mine. Get them to give you and your father priests' hats and robes, as well as the necessary credentials. Then you can travel in disguise."
"Why do I have to pretend to be a priest?"
"Is there no end to your naivete? You, my silly young friend, are an agent of a group planning to kill the shogun, set fire to Ieyasu's castle in Suruga, throw the whole Kanto district into confusion, and take over the government. In short, you're a traitor. If you're caught, the mandatory punishment is death by hanging."
Jotaro's mouth fell open.
"Now go."
"May I ask one question? Why should men who want to overthrow the Tokugawas be considered traitors? Why aren't the ones who overthrew the Toyotomis and seized control of the country traitors?"
"Don't ask me,"
Takuan answered with a cold stare. The Pomegranate. Takuan and Iori arrived at Lord Hojo Jikatsu's mansion in Ushigome later the same day. A young retainer stationed at the gate went to announce Takuan, and a few minutes later Shinzo came out.
"My father is at Edo Castle," said Shinzo. "Won't you come in and wait?"
"At the castle?" said Takuan.
"I'll go on then, since that's where I was headed anyway. Would you mind if I left Iori here with you?"
"Not at all," replied Shinzo, with a smile and a quick glance at Iori. "May I order a palanquin for you?"
"If you would."
The lacquered palanquin was barely out of sight before Iori was at the stables, inspecting Lord Ujikatsu's well-fed chestnut browns and dappled grays, one by one. He particularly admired their faces, which he thought much more aristocratic than those of workhorses of his acquaintance. There was a mystery here, though. How could the warrior class afford to keep large numbers of horses standing idle instead of having them out working the fields? He was just beginning to imagine cavalrymen riding into battle when Shinzo's loud voice distracted him. He looked toward the house, expecting a scolding, but saw that the object of Shinzo's wrath was a thin old woman with a staff and a stubbornly set face.
"Pretending to be out?" shouted Shinzo. "Why would my father have to pretend to an old hag he doesn't even know?" "My, aren't you angry?"
Osugi said sarcastically.
"I gather you're his lordship's son. Do you know how many times I've come here trying to see your father? Not a few, I'll tell you, and every time I've been told he's out."
A little rattled, Shinzo said, "It doesn't have anything to do with how many times you come. My father doesn't like to receive people. If he doesn't want to see you, why do you keep coming back?"
Undaunted, Osugi cackled.
"Doesn't like to see people? Why does he live among them, then?" She bared her teeth. The idea of calling her a dirty name and letting her hear the click of his sword being released crossed Shinzo's mind, but he didn't want to make an unseemly show of temper, nor was he sure it would work. "My father is not here," he said, in an ordinary tone of voice. "Why don't you sit down and tell me what this is all about?"
"Well, I think I'll accept your kind offer. It's been a long walk, and my legs are tired."
She sat down on the edge of the step and began rubbing her knees.
"When you speak softly to me, young man, I feel ashamed for raising my voice. Now, I want you to convey what I say to your father when he comes home."
"I'll be glad to do that."
"I came to tell him about Miyamoto Musashi."
Puzzled, Shinzo asked,
"Has something happened to Musashi?"
"No, I want your father to know what kind of man he is.
When Musashi was 17, he went to Sekigahara and fought against the Tokugawas. Against the Tokugawas, do you hear? What's more, he's done so many evil deeds in Mimasaka that no one there has anything good to say about him. He killed any number of people, and he's been running away from me for years because I've been trying to take my rightful revenge on him. Musashi's a useless vagabond, and he's dangerous. Now wait. No, just listen. Musashi started playing around with the woman my son was engaged to. He actually stole her and made off with her."
"Hold on now," said Shinzo, raising his hand in protest. "Why tell such stories about Musashi?"
"I'm doing it for the sake of the country," Osugi said smugly. "What good will it do the country to slander Musashi?"
Osugi rearranged herself and said,
"I hear that slick-tongue rogue is soon to be appointed an instructor in the shogun's house."
"Where did you hear that?"
"A man who was at the Ono Dojo. I heard it with my own ears."
"Did you now?"
"A swine like Musashi shouldn't even be allowed in the shogun's presence, let alone be appointed tutor. A teacher to the house of Tokugawa is a teacher to the nation. It makes me sick just to think of it. I'm here to warn Lord Hojo, because I hear he recommended Musashi. Do you understand now?"
She sucked in the saliva at the corners of her mouth and went on,
"I'm sure it's to the country's benefit to warn your father. And let me warn you, too. Be careful you don't get taken in by Musashi's smooth talk."
Fearing she might go on in this vein for hours, Shinzo summoned his last ounce of patience, swallowed hard, and said,
"Thank you. I understand what you've said. I'll pass it on to my father." "Please do."
With the air of someone who has finally achieved a cherished goal, Osugi got up and walked toward the gate, her sandals flopping noisily on the path.
"Filthy old hag!" cried a boyish voice.
Startled, Osugi barked,
"What? What?"
and looked around until she spotted Iori among the trees, showing his teeth like a horse.
"Eat that!"
he shouted, and flung a pomegranate at her. It struck so hard it broke.
"Ow!"
screamed Osugi, clutching at her chest. She bent to pick up something to throw at him, but he ran out of sight. She ran to the stable and was looking inside when a large, soft lump of horse manure struck her squarely in the face. Sputtering and spitting, Osugi wiped the mess from her face with her fingers, and the tears began to flow. To think that traveling about the country on her son's behalf had led to this sort of thing. Iori watched at a safe distance from behind a tree. Seeing her weeping like an infant, he was suddenly very ashamed of himself. He half wanted to go and apologize to her before she got out the gate, but his fury at hearing her malign Musashi had not subsided. Caught between pity and hatred, He stood there for a time, biting his fingernails.
"Come up here, Iori. You can see the red Fuji."
Shinzo's voice came from a room high up on the hill. With a great sense of relief, Iori ran off.
"Mount Fuji?"
The vision of the peak, dyed crimson in the evening light, emptied his mind of all other thoughts. Shinzo, too, seemed to have forgotten his conversation with Osugi. Land of Dreams. Ieyasu turned the office of shogun over to Hidetada in 1605, but continued to govern from his castle in Suruga. Now that the work of laying the foundations for the new regime was largely completed, he was beginning to let Hidetada take over his rightful duties. When he yielded his authority, Ieyasu had asked his son what he intended to do. Hidetada's reply, "I'm going to build," was said to please the old shogun immensely. In contrast to Edo, Osaka was still preoccupied with preparations for the final battle. Illustrious generals laid secret plots, couriers carried messages to certain fiefs, displaced military leaders and ronin were provided with solace and compensation. Ammunition was stockpiled, lances polished, moats deepened. And more townsmen deserted the western cities for the booming city in the east, frequently changing loyalties, for the fear lingered that a Toyotomi victory might mean a reversion to chronic strife. To the daimyo and higher-ranking vassals who had yet to decide whether to entrust the fate of their children and grandchildren to Edo or Osaka, the impressive construction program in Edo was an argument in favor of the Tokugawas. Today, as on many other days, Hidetada was engaged in one of his favorite pastimes. Dressed as though for a country outing, he left the main encirclement and went to the hill at Fukiage to inspect the construction work. At about the time the shogun and his retinue of ministers, personal attendants, and Buddhist priests stopped for a rest, a commotion broke out at the bottom of the Momiji Hill.
"Stop the son of a bitch! Catch him!"
A well-digger was running around in circles, trying to shake off the carpenters who were chasing him. He darted like a hare between stacks of lumber and hid briefly behind a plasterer's hut. Then he made a dash for the scaffolding on the outer wall and began climbing. Cursing loudly, a couple of the carpenters climbed after him and caught hold of his feet. The well-digger, arms waving frantically, fell back into a pile of shavings. The carpenters fell on him, kicking and beating him from all sides. For some strange reason, he neither cried out nor attempted to resist, but clung as tightly as he could to the ground, as if that was his only hope. The samurai in charge of the carpenters and the inspector of workmen came running up.
"What's going on here?"
asked the samurai.
"He stepped on my square, the filthy pig," one carpenter whined. "A square is a carpenter's soul." "Get a hold of yourself." "What would you do if he walked on your sword?" demanded the carpenter. "All right, that's enough. The shogun is resting up there on the hill."
Hearing the shogun mentioned, the first carpenter quieted down. But another man said,
"He's got to wash. Then he's got to bow to the square and apologize."
"We'll take care of the punishment," said the inspector. "You men go back to work."
He seized the prostrate man by the collar and said, "Lift your face."
"Yes, sir."
"You're one of the well diggers, aren't you?"
"Yes, sir."
"What are you doing down here? This isn't where you work."
"He was around here yesterday, too," said the carpenter.
"Was he?"
said the inspector, staring at Matahachi's pale face and noticing that for a well digger, he was a little too delicate, a little too refined. He conferred with the samurai for a minute, then led Matahachi away. Matahachi was locked in a woodshed behind the office of the inspector of workmen, and for the next several days had nothing to look at but some firewood, a sack or two of charcoal, and barrels for making pickles. Fearing the plot would be discovered, he was soon in a state of terror. Once inside the castle, he He'd reconsidered and decided that if it meant being a well digger the rest of his life, he wasn't going to become an assassin. He'd seen the shogun and his entourage several times and done nothing.